This is Audible.
Ben Bella Books presents Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters, by Stephen E. Koonin. Read by Jay Ossing. For my many mentors who taught me the importance of scientific integrity. Introduction. The science. We're all supposed to know what the science says. The science, we're told, is settled. How many times have you heard it? Humans have already broken the Earth's climate. Temperatures are rising. Sea level is surging. Ice is disappearing. And heat waves, storms, droughts, floods, and wildfires are an ever-worsening scourge on the world. Greenhouse gas emissions are causing all of this. And unless they're eliminated promptly by radical changes to society and its energy systems, the science says Earth is doomed. Well, not quite. Yes, it's true that the globe is warming, and that humans are exerting a warming influence upon it. But beyond that, to paraphrase the classic movie The Princess Bride, I do not think the science says what you think it says. For example, both the research literature and government reports that summarize and assess the state of climate science say clearly that heat waves in the U.S. are now no more common than they were in 1900, and that the warmest temperatures in the U.S. have not risen in the past 50 years. When I tell people this, most are incredulous, some gasp, and some get downright hostile. But these are almost certainly not the only climate facts you haven't heard. Here are three more that might surprise you, drawn directly from recent published research or the latest assessments of climate science published by the U.S. government and the UN. Humans have had no detectable impact on hurricanes over the past century. Greenland's ice sheet isn't shrinking any more rapidly today than it was 80 years ago. The net economic impact of human-induced climate change will be minimal through at least the end of this century. So what gives? If you're like most people, after the surprise wears off, you'll wonder why you're surprised. Why haven't you heard these facts before? Why don't they line up with the narrative, now almost a meme, that we've already broken the climate and face certain doom unless we change our ways? Most of the disconnect comes from the long game of telephone that starts with the research literature and runs through the assessment reports to the summaries of the assessment reports and on to the media coverage. There are abundant opportunities to get things wrong, both accidentally and on purpose, as the information goes through filter after filter to be packaged for various audiences. The public gets their climate information almost exclusively from the media. Very few people actually read the assessment summaries, let alone the reports and research papers themselves. That's perfectly understandable. The data and analyses are nearly impenetrable for non-experts, and the writing is not exactly gripping. As a result, most people don't get the whole story. But don't feel bad. It's not only the public that's ill-informed about what the science says about climate. Policymakers, too, have to rely on information that's been put through several different ringers by the time it gets to them. Because most government officials, and others involved in climate policy for the public and private sectors, are not themselves scientists, it's up to scientists to make sure that non-scientists making key policy decisions get an accurate, complete, and transparent picture of what's known and unknown about the changing climate, one undistorted by agenda or narrative. Unfortunately, getting that story straight isn't as easy as it sounds. I should know. That used to be my job. Where I'm coming from. I'm a scientist. I work to understand the world through measurements and observations, and then to communicate clearly both the excitement and the implications of that understanding. Early in my career, I had great fun doing this for esoteric phenomena in the realm of atoms and nuclei using high-performance computer modeling, which is also an important tool for much of climate science. But beginning in 2004, I spent about a decade turning those same methods to the subject of climate and its implications for energy technologies. I did this first as chief scientist for the oil company BP, where I focused on advancing renewable energy, and then as Undersecretary for Science in the Obama administration's Department of Energy, where I helped guide the government's investments in energy technologies and climate science. I found great satisfaction in these roles, helping to define and catalyze actions that would reduce carbon dioxide emissions, the agreed-upon imperative that would save the planet. But then the doubts began. In late 2013, I was asked by the American Physical Society, the professional organization of the country's physicists, to lead an update of its public statement on climate. As part of that effort, in January 2014, I convened a workshop with a specific objective: to stress test the state of climate science. In ordinary terms, that meant analyzing, critiquing, and summarizing humanity's accumulated knowledge about the past, present, and future of the Earth's climate. Six leading climate experts and six leading physicists, myself included, spent a day scrutinizing exactly what we know about the climate system and how confidently we can project its future. To focus the conversation, we physicists had spent the prior 2 months preparing a framing document based on the UN assessment report that had just been released. We posed some specific and crucial questions along the lines of, where is the data poor or the assumptions weakly supported, and does that matter? How reliable are the models that we use to describe the past and project the future? Many who've read the workshop transcript were struck by how successfully, and unusually, it brought out the certainties and uncertainties of the science at that time. For my part, I came away from the APS workshop not only surprised, but shaken by the realization that climate science was far less mature than I had supposed. Here's what I discovered. Humans exert a growing, but physically small, warming influence on the climate. The deficiencies of climate data challenge our ability to untangle the response to human influences from poorly understood natural changes. The results from the multitude of climate models disagree with, or even contradict, each other and many kinds of observations. A vague expert judgment was sometimes applied to adjust model results and obfuscate shortcomings. Government and UN press releases and summaries do not accurately reflect the reports themselves. There was a consensus at the meeting on some important issues, but not at all the strong consensus the media promulgates. Distinguished climate experts, including report authors themselves, are embarrassed by some media portrayals of the science. This was somewhat shocking. In short, the science is insufficient to make useful projections about how the climate will change over the coming decades, much less what effect our actions will have on it. Why were these crucial deficiencies such a revelation to me and others? As a scientist, I felt the scientific community was letting the public down by not telling the whole truth plainly. And as a citizen, I was concerned that the public and political debates were being misinformed. So I began to speak out, most publicly through a 2,000-word Saturday essay published in the Wall Street Journal that September. In it, I outlined some of the uncertainties in climate science and argued that ignoring them could hinder our ability to understand and respond to a changing climate. Policymakers and the public may wish for the comfort of certainty in their climate science, but I fear that rigidly promulgating the idea that climate science is settled, or is a hoax, demeans and chills the scientific enterprise, retarding its progress in these important matters. Uncertainty is a prime mover and motivator of science, and must be faced head on. That piece drew thousands of online comments, the great majority of them supportive. My frankness about the state of climate science was less popular in the scientific community, however. As the chair of a highly respected university earth sciences department told me privately, "I agree with pretty much everything you wrote, but I don't dare say that in public." Many scientific colleagues, some of them my friends for decades, were outraged that I'd highlight problems with the science, and thus, as one of them said, give ammunition to the deniers. Another said it would have been okay to publish my essay in some obscure scientific journal, but reproached me for doing so in a forum with so many readers. And a prominent defender of the idea that the science is settled enough published a response to my op-ed that began by calling for New York University to reconsider my employment, went on to misrepresent many of the things I had written, but then, bafflingly, acknowledged that most of the uncertainties I'd mentioned were well known and much discussed among experts. It seems that by highlighting those uncertainties so plainly and publicly, I had inadvertently broken some code of silence, like the Mafia's omerta. More than 6 years of study since the APS workshop have left me increasingly dismayed at the public discussions of climate and energy. Climate alarmism has come to dominate U.S. politics, especially among Democrats, where I have otherwise long felt most comfortable politically. The 2020 Democratic presidential primary saw each candidate trying to outdo the other with over-the-top statements about climate emergency and climate crisis, increasingly divorced from the science. The election run-up also witnessed increasingly sweeping policy proposals like the Green New Deal that would fight climate change with government interventions and subsidies. Not surprisingly, the Biden administration has made climate and energy a major priority, with the appointment of former Secretary of State John Kerry as climate envoy, and proposed spending of almost $2 trillion to fight this existential threat to humanity. While I have no informed opinions on the fiscal and policy merits of proposals like the Green New Deal, I am a physicist, not an economist, I do know that any policy should be based upon what the science actually says about the changing climate. Trillion-dollar decisions about reducing human influences on the climate are, in the end, about values, risk tolerance, intergenerational and geographical equities, and a balance among economic development, environmental impact, and energy cost, availability, and reliability. But they must be informed by an accurate understanding of scientific certainties and uncertainties. This book is an attempt to set us on the road to that understanding. And I intend to do it the only way that a scientist knows how, with documented facts, almost all drawn from the most up-to-date official assessments or quality research literature, presented in their proper context. As the late Representative John Lewis, the conscience of Congress, said in his speech about the first impeachment of President Trump, "When you see something that is not right, not just, not fair, you have a moral obligation to say something, do something." My late Caltech colleague Richard Feynman was one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century, renowned for both the creativity and importance of his research, including Nobel Prize-winning work on quantum electrodynamics. Irreverence, showmanship, and the ability to tell a good story were also part of what made him a legend. He was a character, one with extraordinary intellectual substance. I was one of many aspiring physicists attracted to Caltech by Feynman's presence. Before I arrived in the fall of 1968, I had already read his wonderful Red Book series of physics lectures cover to cover multiple times. My 4 undergraduate years at Caltech were lived pretty much as those depicted in The Big Bang Theory, except without the laugh track. The highlights included some one-on-one conversations with Feynman. He loved interacting with young scientists, as well as a memorable session playing bongo drums with the great man himself during my first year. Scientific integrity is central to the Caltech ethos. Its importance is impressed upon new students from their first day on campus, and Feynman's absolute intellectual honesty demonstrated for students and faculty alike what this means for a working scientist. At the 1974 Caltech commencement, he gave a now famous address titled "Cargo Cult Science." Its topic was the rigor scientists must adopt to avoid fooling not only themselves, but also others. In summary, the idea is to try to give all of the information to help others to judge the value of your contribution, not just the information that leads to judgment in one particular direction or another. The easiest way to explain this idea is to contrast it, for example, with advertising. Last night, I heard that Wesson Oil doesn't soak through food. Well, that's true. It's not dishonest. But the thing I'm talking about is not just a matter of not being dishonest. It's a matter of scientific integrity, which is another level. The fact that should be added to that advertising statement is that no oils soak through food if operated at a certain temperature. If operated at another temperature, they all will, including Wesson Oil. So it's the implication which has been conveyed, not the fact, which is true. And the difference is what we have to deal with. Much of the public portrayal of climate science suffers from Feynman's Wesson Oil problem. In an effort to persuade rather than inform, the information presented withholds either essential context or what doesn't fit. And coincidentally, as with cooking oil, it's mostly a matter of temperature. Most of the climate researchers I've met pursue their work with the objectivity and rigor that are the norm in every field of science. But because the potential impact of a changing climate strikes at human existence itself, the issue understandably engenders passion and emotion. Some people argue that there's no harm in a bit of misinformation if it helps save the planet. And indeed, when phrases like this, however unwarranted or inaccurate, are being used to describe the stakes, perhaps it isn't surprising that some climate scientists are less than objective when talking to the public. The late Stephen Schneider, a prominent climate researcher, said it explicitly as early as 1989. On the one hand, as scientists, we are ethically bound to the scientific method, in effect promising to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but, which means that we must include all the doubts, the caveats, the ifs, ands, and buts. On the other hand, we are not just scientists, but human beings as well. And like most people, we'd like to see the world a better place, which in this context translates into our working to reduce the risk of potentially disastrous climatic change. To do that, we need to get some broad-based support to capture the public's imagination. That, of course, entails getting loads of media coverage. So we have to offer up scary scenarios, make simplified dramatic statements, and make little mention of any doubts we might have. This double ethical bind we frequently find ourselves in cannot be solved by any formula. Each of us has to decide what the right balance is between being effective and being honest. I hope that means being both. Many others have made similar points or commented on the dark side of Schneider's supposed double bind. For example, it doesn't matter what is true. It only matters what people believe is true. Paul Watson, co-founder of Greenpeace. We've got to ride this global warming issue. Even if the theory of global warming is wrong, we will be doing the right thing in terms of economic and environmental policy. Timothy Wirth, president of the UN Foundation. Some colleagues, who share some of my doubts, argue that the only way to get our society to change is to frighten people with the possibility of a catastrophe, and that therefore it is all right and even necessary for scientists to exaggerate. They tell me that my belief in open and honest assessment is naive. Daniel Botkin, former chair of environmental studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And so the media is filled with scary climate predictions. Here are a few old enough to have been proven wrong. Inaction will cause, by the turn of the century, 2000, an ecological catastrophe which will witness devastation as complete, as irreversible as any nuclear holocaust. Mostafa Tolba, former executive director of the United Nations Environment Program, 1982. Within a few years, winter snowfall in the UK will become a very rare and exciting event. Children just aren't going to know what snow is. David Viner, senior research scientist, 2000. European cities will be plunged beneath rising seas as Britain is plunged into a Siberian climate by 2020. Mark Townsend and Paul Harris, quoting a Pentagon report in The Guardian, 2004. Although Schneider later spent many words trying to explain his statement about the double ethical bind, I believe the underlying premise is dangerously wrong. There should be no question about what the right balance is between being effective and being honest. It is the height of hubris for a scientist even to consider deliberately misinforming policy discussions in service of what they believe to be ethical. This would seem obvious in other contexts. Imagine the outcry if it were discovered that scientists were misrepresenting data on birth control because of their religious beliefs, for instance. Philip Handler, a former president of the National Academy of Sciences, identified the problem in a 1980 editorial that resonates eerily four decades later. Difficulty arises in the scientific community from confusion of the role of scientist qua scientist with that of scientist as citizen, confusion of the ethical code of the scientist with the obligation of the citizen, blurring the distinction between intrinsically scientific and intrinsically political questions. When scientists fail to recognize these boundaries, their own ideological beliefs, usually unspoken, easily becloud seemingly scientific debate. With scientists' unique role comes a special responsibility. We're the only people who can bring objective science to the discussion, and that is our overriding ethical obligation. Like judges, We're obligated to put personal feelings aside as we do our job. When we fail to do this, we usurp the public's right to make informed choices and undermine their confidence in the entire scientific enterprise. There's nothing at all wrong with scientists as activists, but activism masquerading as the science is pernicious. We scientists shouldn't be selling cooking oil. About this book. Unsettled tells two related stories. The first, part one, is about the science of the changing climate, while the second, part two, is about the response that society could make to those changes. Part one begins by clarifying the important questions society asks of climate science: how the climate has changed, how it will change in the future, and what the impact of those changes will be. It also offers some basics about the official assessment reports that we look to for answers to those questions. To understand why it's changing today and how it might change in the future, we need to know how the climate has changed in the past. And chapter one starts in on the science itself by exploring this. The chapter explains both the importance and challenges of obtaining quality observations of the Earth's climate, which is not the same as its weather, over many decades. It also reviews some of the indications of a warming globe and puts them in geological context. Chapter 2 then turns to how the Earth's temperature arises in the first place, from a delicate balance between warming sunlight and cooling heat radiation. We'll see that this balance is disturbed by both human and natural influences, with greenhouse gases playing an important role. Because the climate is very sensitive, we need an accurate and precise understanding of those influences and how they've changed over time. The most important human influence on the climate is the growing concentration of carbon dioxide, CO2, in the atmosphere, largely due to the burning of fossil fuels. This is the focus of Chapter 3, particularly how the connection between CO2 emissions and concentration diminishes the prospect of even stabilizing growing human influences. Computer models of how the climate responds to human and natural influences are the subject of Chapter 4. Drawing upon my half-century involvement with scientific computing and the authorship of a pioneering text on that subject, we'll look at how they work, what they tell us, and some of their deficiencies. These dozens of sophisticated models are what scientists use to make their projections and what the media cites in their coverage. Alas, they give results that differ significantly not only from each other, but from observations. That is, they're right in a few ways, but wrong in many others. In fact, the results have become more divergent with each generation of models. In other words, as our models have become more elaborate, their descriptions of the future have become less certain. Chapter 5 is the first of five chapters dealing with contradictions between the science and the prevailing notion that humans have already broken the climate, exploring areas where the facts and popular perception are at odds, and probing the source of those discrepancies. This chapter focuses on record high temperatures in the U.S. They're no more common today than they were in 1900. Yet you wouldn't know that from the misrepresentations of an allegedly authoritative assessment report. Chapter 6 likewise explains why experts conclude that human influences haven't caused any observable changes in hurricanes, and how assessment reports obscure or distort that finding. In Chapter 7, I describe the modest changes seen in precipitation and related phenomena over the past century, discussing their significance and highlighting some points likely to surprise anyone who follows the news. For instance, that the global area burned by fires each year has declined by 25% since observations began in 1998. Chapter 8 offers a level-headed look at sea levels, which have been rising over the past many millennia. We'll untangle what we really know about human influences on the current rate of rise, about 1 foot per century, and explain why it's very hard to believe that surging seas will drown the coasts anytime soon. Chapter 9 covers a trio of oft-cited climate change impacts: fatalities, famine, and economic ruin, predictions of which are belied by the historical record and assessment report projections, even if it's hard to discern this when reading the reports themselves. Having demonstrated that the science doesn't support what's portrayed in most popular discussions, in Chapter 10, I take up the question of who broke it? Why the science has been communicated so poorly to decision makers and the public? We'll see how overwrought portrayals of a climate crisis serve the interests of diverse players, including environmental activists, the media, politicians, scientists, and scientific institutions. Chapter 11 closes out Part 1 by describing how we might improve communication and understanding of climate science, including adversarial, red team, reviews of the assessment reports, best practices for media coverage, and what non-experts can do to be better informed and more critical consumers of all science media, but especially about the climate. Part 2 begins its discussion of the response story by drawing a distinction between what society could do, what it should do, and what it will do in response to a changing climate. Three very different issues, often conflated, even by experts. Chapter 12 illuminates the will issue by discussing the formidable challenges in meaningfully reducing human influences on the climate, including the lack of progress toward the goals of the Paris Agreement. Chapter 13 sheds some light on the could issue by discussing the tremendous changes it would take to create a zero-carbon energy system in the U.S. The response story wraps up in Chapter 14 with a discussion of Plan B strategies that allow the world to respond to a climate changing from either human or natural causes: adaptation, which will happen, and geoengineering, which could be deployed in extremis. The book concludes with some closing thoughts on climate and energy, including what I believe to be prudent steps society should take, both to improve climate science and the way it's presented to non-experts, as well as to prepare for future climate changes, whether natural or caused by humans. Some practical points about the book. Scientists work in the metric system: temperatures in degrees Celsius, distances in meters or kilometers, etc. However, the imperial system is more common in the U.S. Temperatures in degrees Fahrenheit, distances in feet or miles, and so on. To make the material accessible to the broadest audience, I'll usually quote quantities in both sets of units. It's important to know when to be precise and when approximate is good enough. Let's say you're hoping your pond will ice over for some skating. Water freezes at 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. So if I told you the temperature was about 10 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Fahrenheit, that's much too warm for ice to form, and it wouldn't matter if the actual temperature were 9 degrees Celsius or 11 degrees Celsius. However, if I told you the temperature was about 1 degree Celsius, 34 degrees Fahrenheit, whether it was minus 1 degree Celsius or plus 3 degrees Celsius would make a big difference, and it would be important for me to tell you that it's actually, say, minus 0.3 degrees Celsius. So the precision with which I'll quote numbers will depend upon the context. For example, I might use a phrase like, the U.S. population is about 330 million, even if the official count was actually 329.135 million on January 1, 2020, because the difference doesn't affect the point I'm considering. In other cases, such as the discussion of sea level rise in Chapter 8, a difference between 2.5 millimeters per year and 3.0 millimeters per year, 0.10 inches per year and 0.12 inches per year, does indeed matter, and I'll be appropriately precise. One of the advantages of writing a book as opposed to an op-ed is that it allows not only a deeper discussion, but also the more liberal use of graphs. Please take them in stride. Graphs are the language of data, and data is central to both the science and how it is communicated. Virtually all of the graphs I've chosen are taken from, or are directly adapted from, the assessment reports, the underlying scientific literature, or other official data sources. I've sometimes used versions of official graphs to emphasize that they're what the science says, not what I say. And, of course, I'll always provide information about the source of the graphs or their data. Being a critical reader of scientific graphs is a skill well worth honing. I've included a few figures from popular media to illustrate just how misleading they can be. My grade school class visited the United Nations headquarters building on a field trip some 60 years ago. I remember being impressed by an enormous Iranian carpet hanging in the lobby and being told that the weavers had deliberately introduced a hard-to-notice imperfection in the elaborate design to signify that it was a product of humans. While there are surely imperfections in this book, they are not deliberate. I've done my best to accurately represent the state of the science going into 2021. Even if this book is error-free, alas, I'll be attacked for writing it. Some will question my credentials, saying I'm not a climate scientist. In other words, that I am not formally trained in the earth sciences, even though I've published several papers in the field. In truth, climate science involves many different scientific fields, encompassing the quantum physics of molecules and the classical physics of moving air, water, and ice, the chemical processes in the atmosphere and ocean, the geology of the solid Earth, and the biology of ecosystems. It also includes the technologies used to do the science, including computer modeling on the world's fastest machines, remote sensing from satellites, paleoclimate analysis, and advanced statistical methods. Then there are the related areas of policy, economics, and the energy technologies aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. This enormous swath of knowledge and methods makes the study of climate and energy the ultimate multidisciplinary activity. No single researcher can be an expert in more than two or three of its aspects, so the challenge in assessing and communicating the state of the science is to read widely and critically enough to put together and convey, which requires a skill set all its own, a coherent, fact-based picture of the whole. Like many other climate researchers with a background in physics, including James Hansen and Michael Mann, I found satisfaction in applying a physicist's tools and sensibilities to create that kind of picture, with the additional benefits of my experience in energy technology and advising government and private sector decision makers on not only climate policy, but also other important national matters, including the quality standards for the Human Genome Project and testimony to then-Senator Joe Biden's Foreign Relations Committee on the post-9/11 dangers of dirty bombs. Even if they accept my credentials, some of this book's critics will say that I've ignored the bigger picture, that this book is too focused on aspects of the science that don't support the alleged consensus. Given the great breadth of climate science, however, it has to focus somewhere. After all, each of the assessment reports alone runs to more than 1,000 pages. My focus is on significant points where the popular perception about climate and energy is very different from what the science says. In that way, this book is about more than what's scientifically correct and what isn't. It's also about how the science, with all of its certainties and uncertainties, becomes the science, how it gets summarized and communicated, and what's lost in the process. Not everything you've heard about climate science is wrong, and I've done my best to provide a balanced presentation for each subject I treat within the limits of length and technical level. The references I cite can be consulted for even more information. Yet another criticism will be that my points are inconsequential. But that can't be, since the media, politicians, and even some scientists are constantly highlighting their opposites to support the prevailing narrative. Record-high temperatures are becoming more common. Hurricanes are strengthening under human influences. Climate change will be an economic disaster. Imagine instead headlines like, "Record-high temperatures are becoming rarer. Hurricanes show no sign of human influence." Or, "Global warming won't have much impact on the economy." I think you're unlikely ever to see those headlines, even though they're a lot closer to what the science actually says, as I'll show in the following chapters. Less serious critics will attack me personally. Some will call me a shill for the fossil fuel industries, even as my resume shows otherwise. Others will say I'm a climate denier. An actual climate denier would be, say, an anti-science politician who refuses to accept the evidence of the data. Quite the opposite of my position. How can I be denying the science if what I'm saying is straight out of the official data and reports? I find it particularly abhorrent to have a call for open scientific discussion equated with Holocaust denial, especially since the Nazis killed more than 200 of my relatives in Eastern Europe. Leaving name-calling aside, I also expect this book to be criticized by, perhaps former, friends in the scientific community, who will question, as they did with that first op-ed of mine, why I'm saying such things to a broad audience, even if my points are well known to experts. The reason is one I've already discussed. For a scientist, I believe it is a responsibility, almost an act of conscience, to portray without bias just how settled, or unsettled, the science truly is. I hope that readers approach this book with an open mind. There has been far too little serious public discussion about the knowns and unknowns of climate science, perhaps unsurprisingly, given the pitch of the rhetoric. In a speech in which he compared human-caused climate change to weapons of mass destruction, then-Secretary of State John Kerry, now the Biden administration's climate envoy, said, "The science is unequivocal. President Obama and I believe very deeply that we do not have time for a meeting anywhere of the Flat Earth Society." But the science is not settled. Open debate is at the heart of the scientific process. It is absurd that scientists should fear being labeled anti-science for engaging in it. In that light, this book issues a challenge and solicits, indeed welcomes informed argument and disagreement. This would be an important step toward wiser societal decisions on climate and energy, and less heat in the debate over the science of our warming planet. Part 1. The Science. My wife and I have 3 children. Like most parents, we tried to guide their childhood development, both by example and by rewarding good behavior and admonishing bad, in the hopes that they would grow into happy, productive adults. Of course, human nature being what it is, each of our 3 kids responded to our influences differently, depending upon the mix of genes they inherited and other experiences they had growing up. Those responses have had impacts on their lives. While there have been bumps in the road for each of them, we're very proud of the unique adults our children have become. Those same 3 issues, influence, response, and impact, form the core questions of climate science. How have humans influenced the climate, and how will those influences change in the future? How does the climate respond to human and natural influences? How will the climate's response impact ecosystems and societies? The past few decades have seen an enormous international effort to answer these questions. Of course, science being what it is, none of these answers is, or ever will be, entirely certain. And since the answer to each question depends upon the answer to the one before it, we can expect that answers to the final, and perhaps most significant, question will be the most uncertain. Understanding uncertainties. The science we learn in grade school is a collection of certainties about the natural world. The Earth revolves around the sun, DNA carries the blueprint of an organism, and so on. Only when you start to learn the practice of science do you realize that each of these facts was hard-won through a succession of logical inferences based upon many observations or experiments. The process of science is less about collecting pieces of knowledge than it is about reducing the uncertainties in what we know. Our uncertainties can be greater or lesser for any given piece of knowledge, depending upon where we are in that process. Today, we are quite certain of how an apple will fall from a tree, but our understanding of turbulent fluid flow, such as convection in the atmosphere, remains a work in progress after more than a century of effort. Every measurement of the physical world has an associated uncertainty interval, usually denoted by the Greek letter sigma. We can't say what the measurement's true value is precisely, only that it is likely to be within some range specified by sigma. Thus, we might say the global mean surface temperature in 2016 was 14.85 degrees Celsius, with a sigma of 0.07 degrees Celsius. That is, there is a 2/3 chance that the true value is between 14.78 and 14.92 degrees Celsius. For a scientist, knowing the uncertainty in a measurement is as important as knowing the measurement itself, because it allows you to judge the significance of differences between measurements. If the temperature in 2016 were 14.85 plus or minus 0.07 degrees Celsius, the first number is the value, and the second its sigma, and it was measured at 14.54 plus or minus 0.07 degrees Celsius in 2005, a scientist would declare the difference of 0.31 degrees Celsius significant, since it's more than 4 times the uncertainties in the measurements themselves. On the other hand, the measured annual increase of 0.04 degrees Celsius between 2015, 14.81 plus or minus 0.07 degrees Celsius, and 2016 is insignificant, since it is smaller than the uncertainties, about half as large, in fact. The media might well still scream, "Temperatures continue to rise," either out of ignorance or to capture readers' attention. But this is like political commentators getting into a tizzy about a 1 percentage point change in a poll when the poll's margin of error, its sigma, is 3 points. Uncertainties and significance in measurements are a common language among all scientists. But talking about the uncertainties in our higher level understanding of climate, particularly to non-scientists, is trickier. To more precisely convey the extent of the unknowns involved, the assessment reports have developed a formal language, as shown in this table. IPCC Likelihood Scale. Term: likelihood of the outcome. Virtually certain: 99 to 100% probability. Very likely: 90 to 100% probability. likely, 66 to 100% probability. About as likely as not, 33 to 66% probability. Unlikely, 0 to 33% probability. Very unlikely, 0 to 10% probability. Exceptionally unlikely, 0 to 1% probability. In this language, a statement that is virtually certain has at most a 1% likelihood of being incorrect, while a statement that's likely has about a 2/3 chance of being true, and a very unlikely statement has at most a 10% chance of being true. Because climate science is complex, uncertainties aren't always easy to quantify in terms of probabilities. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has therefore established a second set of calibrated terms to indicate confidence in a given finding. Confidence is a qualitative judgment that depends upon the number, quality, and agreement of different lines of evidence. The five levels of confidence are very high, high, medium, low, and very low, as illustrated in the IPCC chart below. The IPCC reports make many explicit confidence assessments. Climate science is a lively field. Thousands of researchers, supported by billions of dollars, work to observe the climate, understand it, and project its future. They report their results in scientific journal articles, publishing more than 10,000 each year. In most other fields of science, that would be the end of the story. However, climate science isn't just any other field. Because the answers to its core questions are so important, with huge potential impact on human society, the United Nations and the U.S. government regularly convene large groups of researchers to prepare formal assessment reports meant to provide best answers for non-experts, including scientists in other fields, decision-makers in government and the private sector, and the public. Those reports, which run to many hundreds of pages each, review and summarize recent research and interpret its findings for non-scientists. The most recent are the Fifth Assessment Report, AR5, released by the IPCC in 2013, and the Fourth National Climate Assessment, NCA 2018, released by the United States Global Change Research Program, USGCRP, in two installments in 2017 and 2018. Great fanfare and intense media coverage accompany the release of each of these reports. About assessment reports. The most prominent series of assessment reports is produced under the auspices of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which was established in 1988. The IPCC issued its first assessment in 1990. The fourth assessment report, termed AR4, was issued in 2007. The fifth AR5 in 2013, and the sixth, AR6, is expected in the summer of 2021. The foundational section of each of the AR reports is that from the so-called Working Group 1, WG1. It deals with the physical aspects of the climate system, in particular the changes observed in recent decades, and how the climate responds to human and natural influences. Other working groups build upon the WG1 assessment to describe the impacts of a changing climate and society's response to them. Each working group also prepares a distillation of their section, called a Summary for Policymakers, SPM. A synthesis of all sections is published as well. Along with its comprehensive AR series of assessments, the IPCC also publishes more focused special reports, such as those on extreme events, the ocean and cryosphere, or climate change and land. The U.S. government also issues its own independent series of assessment reports. The Global Change Research Act of 1990 requires a National Climate Assessment, NCA, every 4 years. Those reports are produced by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, USGCRP. The NCA reports have much the same purpose as the IPCC's ARs, although with more of a U.S. focus. The content of the NCAs generally aligns with the substance of the ARs, but there can be differences in emphasis and language. The first three NCAs were issued in 2000, 2009, and 2014. The George W. Bush administration was less than diligent about it. The fourth, NCA 2018, comprises two volumes. Volume 1, focused on physical climate science, was released in November 2017 as the Climate Science Special Report, CSSR. Volume 2, released in November 2018, focused on the impacts and risks of a changing climate, as well as on how we might adapt. The analysis of future climate impacts in Volume 2 naturally builds upon projections of future climate change in the CSSR. Its credibility, therefore, depends crucially upon the extent to which the CSSR faithfully portrays the certainties and uncertainties in climate science. The fifth NCA is expected in 2023. The AR and NCA assessments are drafted and reviewed by similar processes. The sponsoring organization, the IPCC or USGCRP, identifies teams of expert authors for each chapter. Those teams produce successive drafts that are refined in response to comments from still other experts. The NCA also undergoes a formal review by a panel convened by the National Academies. The entire process takes years. For example, the first meeting of the lead authors for AR6 took place in June 2018, about 3 years before the report's planned release. Production of the CSSR ran more quickly, but it still took about 20 months to draft and review. The assessment reports literally define the science for non-experts. Given the intensive authoring and review processes, any reader would naturally expect that their assessments and summaries of the research literature are complete, objective, and transparent. The gold standard. In my experience, the reports largely do meet that expectation, and so much of the detail in the first part of this book, The Science Story, is drawn from them. But a careful reading of the most recent assessment reports also reveals some elementary failures that mislead or misinform readers on important points. What those failures are, how they came about, how the media promulgates them, and what can be done to correct them is another dimension of the science story. Organizations and individuals further along in the game of telephone rely on the assessment reports when talking about climate. For example, a 2019 report by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, entitled How We Respond, references NCA 2018 when it opens with this high-level summary of the science. Our nation, our states, our cities, and our towns face an urgent problem: climate change. Americans are already feeling its effects and will continue to do so in the coming decades. Rising temperatures will impact farmers in their fields and transit riders in cities. Across the country, extreme weather events such as hurricanes, floods, wildfires, and drought are occurring with greater frequency and intensity. While these problems pose numerous risks to society and the planet, undoubtedly the biggest risk would be to do nothing. Science tells us that the sooner we respond to climate change, the lower the risks and the costs will be in the future. I have been a member of the AAAS for almost 5 decades and was named a fellow of the organization many years ago. So I can tell you that the statement above was never submitted for comment, let alone endorsement, by the organization's 120,000 members. Had I been asked to comment, I would have offered a somewhat different statement based upon my familiarity with the assessment reports and literature. The Earth has warmed during the past century, partly because of natural phenomena and partly in response to growing human influences. These human influences, most importantly the accumulation of CO2 from burning fossil fuels, exert a physically small effect on the complex climate system. Unfortunately, our limited observations and understanding are insufficient to usefully quantify either how the climate will respond to human influences or how it varies naturally. However, even as human influences have increased almost fivefold since 1950, and the globe has warmed modestly, most severe weather phenomena remain within past variability. Projections of future climate and weather events rely on models demonstrably unfit for the purpose. Later, I'll further explore some of the reasons why individuals and organizations, the AAAS among them, tend toward unsupported hyperbole when communicating on the subject of climate, and I'll outline some steps that would move the discussion away from an unseemly posture of persuasion toward a more professional stance of imparting information impartially, completely, and with context. The following chapters will support the more factual, cautious, and less alarming tone of my take. After all, I'm not selling cooking oil. 1. What we know about warming. I've had an urge to measure the world since I was a child. temperature was one of my early fascinations, and I became intrigued with a small alcohol thermometer in my kindergarten classroom. How did it work? Why did it change? Eventually, my 5-year-old mind became curious about what the thermometer would show if I took it into the school hallway, and then out of the building. So one winter day, as the class was about to be dismissed, I pocketed the thermometer and walked out of the classroom. I was delighted to see the reading drop as I walked home from school, and then rise again as I entered my house. Unfortunately, my mother discovered my unauthorized borrowing of experimental apparatus when I put the thermometer into our freezer. The next morning, I was made to return it, apologize to my teacher, and promise not to take it again. All in all, a good life lesson. And a few days later, my parents presented me with my own thermometer. As I knew instinctively in childhood, understanding the natural world starts with measurements, the data. But gathering useful global climate data is much more involved than simply carrying around a pocket thermometer. The Earth is large and not easy to cover, particularly the 70% that's oceans. And since we're looking for small changes over decades, we need records that are accurate, precise, having small uncertainties, and span a long period. And even when we've got good data, the story it tells is seldom simple. We'll see in this chapter that there is much more to the story of global temperature change than humans are warming the Earth. Most everyone has seen some version of the iconic graph in Figure 1.1, showing the Earth's temperature rising by about 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degree Fahrenheit, since 1850, with what appears to be a sharp uptick in slope beginning around 1980. It sure looks like something is changing. But exactly what is that graph? After all, you'll notice it reads temperature anomalies rather than temperature. Moreover, the annual average temperature in, say, New York City, about 13 degrees Celsius or 55 degrees Fahrenheit, can vary from year to year by more than 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, greater than the entire range of the graph. So should we be concerned by these long-term changes, which the inset shows are quite small in terms of the globe's actual temperature? What is this graph really telling us? Even as a 5-year-old experimenting with a purloined thermometer, I was able to see that temperature varies from place to place and changes over time. Today, thousands of observing stations around the world and dozens of satellites overhead are continuously documenting those changes, and much else about the weather, all over the planet. Weather bureaus assemble and analyze these observations to produce the forecasts that guide our day-to-day plans. However useful they are in helping us decide whether to take a sweater when we leave the house in the morning, using weather observations to learn something about the climate is altogether more complicated, because climate is not the weather, a distinction often missing in popular discussion. The weather anywhere varies constantly in ways both predictable and unexpected. Through the day, it's usually warmer at 4 p.m. than it is at 4 a.m. Across days, as when a front passes through, with the seasons, and from year to year. On the other hand, a location's climate is the average of its weather over decades. In fact, the UN's World Meteorological Organization defines climate as a 30-year average, although climate researchers will sometimes discuss averages over a period as short as 10 years. So changes in the weather from one year to another do not constitute changes in climate. Non-experts often confuse climate and weather. Experts sometimes do as well, occasionally deliberately. Here's an example that clarifies the difference between the two. If you are moving from Wisconsin to southern Arizona, knowledge about your new home's climate tells you to invest in air conditioning for the summers, that it's probably safe to leave your heavy winter coats behind, and that the water-loving plants that flourish in Madison are unlikely to fare as well in Tucson. But knowledge about the weather tells you that, according to Tuesday's forecast, you'll need an umbrella when you arrive on Thursday. An aphorism traceable to 1901 captures it well. Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get. Because climate is an average over many years, it changes slowly. It takes at least a decade of observations to define a climate, and so two or more decades to identify a change in it. Those long times verge on the limit of human memory, particularly when changes are small, so we need records to keep from being fooled. What garners most popular attention are extreme weather events, like storms and heat waves. Their numbers and intensities also vary from year to year, But again, it's their average properties over decades that define the climate. Not only can we be fooled by failing to take a big picture view of climate over time, but we can also be fooled by failing to take a big picture view of the planet. Climate varies from place to place depending upon things like latitude, it's colder toward the poles, elevation, it's colder on mountains, and proximity to water, a moderating influence. The average daily high temperature in Singapore is about 33 degrees Celsius, 91 degrees Fahrenheit, all year, while it's minus 4 degrees Celsius, 25 degrees Fahrenheit, in Moscow during January, and 24 degrees Celsius, 75 degrees Fahrenheit, in July. To assess the effects of human influences, it's best to consider the temperature over large regions of the globe, both because the influences of greatest concern, such as greenhouse gases, act worldwide, and because averaging over large areas makes small changes in climate more evident by bringing them out of the noise. Alas, it isn't easy to measure the surface temperature over the whole Earth, particularly when you're looking for changes of a fraction of a degree over decades. You have to worry about variations in the thermometers themselves, how they're housed, and exactly where they're located. And even if a station hasn't been moved over the years, urbanization around a site is a concern, since buildings, roads, and concentrated human activity make cities a few degrees warmer than their rural surroundings. Most importantly, how can we possibly measure the temperature of the globe if we don't have a thermometer everywhere? Fortunately, a landmark paper in 1987 by Hansen and Lebedev showed that locations less than 1,200 kilometers, 750 miles, apart have, on average, similar temperature changes. In other words, if the average temperature rises by a degree in one location, it's likely, but not guaranteed, to do the same in other locations nearby. This lets us judge temperature changes over a large area using only a sparse network of stations, and the gaps in coverage can be filled in probabilistically. Figure 1.1 shows that four independent groups using different analysis methods come to very similar global surface temperature records based on this general idea. Speaking of Figure 1.1, let's return to our earlier question. Why temperature anomalies instead of temperature? Anomalies measure how much the observed condition, in this case temperature, at a location deviates from the baseline, average, value at that location. Using values relative to a baseline puts changes in the Arctic on the same footing as changes in the tropics, allowing us to compare changes in climate between locations as well as over time, and so tease out large-scale trends. The baseline is usually chosen as the average over a 30-year period in the middle of the time span being considered, chosen as 1951 to 1980 in Figure 1.1. This choice is somewhat arbitrary, but the arbitrariness is unimportant since choosing a different baseline would simply shift the curve up or down, but it wouldn't change its shape or size. Remember, we're interested in changes in climate. So that's the global temperature anomaly graph of Figure 1.1. The deviation of the average daily temperature from its expected value, averaged over each day of the year and over the whole globe. Looking at it, we can see that the global average anomaly has gone up over the past century. Of course, that doesn't mean the temperature everywhere has gone up all of the time or by the same amount. But its change over time does give us some important and interesting information. One striking feature of the global average surface temperature record shown in Figure 1.1 is that, even though the data fluctuates from year to year, there are clear trends over decades, with ups and downs superimposed on an overall warming trend. That is, the history is not just a jumbled sequence of random values. Most climate-related time series show a pattern like this, that is, of long-term trends visible despite year-to-year variation. The phenomenon was discovered by the British hydrologist H.E. Hirst, who was studying the water level of the Nile River, which is sensitive to rainfall over about 10% of the African continent. Figure 1.2 shows the minimum Nile water depth observed each year by the Rota Nilometer near Cairo over the more than 650 years from 622 to 1284 AD. As you can see, even as the year-to-year values fluctuate, sometimes dramatically, the 30-year averages indicated by the solid line show clear trends over decades, just as in the global temperature data from Figure 1.1. Looking at the signal of longer-term trends rather than the noise of short-term variations helps us see the big picture so crucial to understanding climate. Despite media coverage to the contrary, even a few unusual years do not mean a change in climate. And so researchers often describe changes in the climate in terms of simple trends over decades. For example, the global temperature anomaly graph in Figure 1.1 starts at about minus 0.3 degrees Celsius in 1900 and ends at about plus 0.8 degrees Celsius in 2020, thus showing a rise of 1.1 degrees Celsius over 120 years, 12 decades, or 0.09 degrees Celsius per decade. But while that describes the average temperature behavior over the entire record, it's not a very good description of the data, as there have been periods of several decades with very different behaviors. For instance, the rate of rise was twice as large as our 0.09 degrees Celsius per decade long-term average during the 40 years from 1980 to 2020, 0.20 degrees Celsius per decade, while it was negative during the 40 years from 1940 to 1980, minus 0.05 degrees Celsius per decade. And for the 30 years before that, from 1910 to 1940, the rate of rise was again nearly twice the 0.09 degrees Celsius per decade average, about 0.17 degrees Celsius per decade. So trends are often highly dependent on the time span being considered. Here we can get almost any trend we want, depending upon which interval we choose. Such cherry-picking of data is unfortunately quite common in the media, and occasionally in the assessment reports, when the goal is to persuade. But if the goal is to inform, it is crucial to present and discuss the entire data set, with all the ups and downs that are significant on whatever scale you're talking about. Scale, that big picture we keep referencing, is also important because it helps us untangle global and local climate changes. August is high season for hot weather coverage in the Northern Hemisphere media, and on August 13th, 2019, the Washington Post